Each year since 2021, UVM Health, in partnership with the University of Vermont, Lerner College of Medicine, and the College of Nursing and Health Sciences, has hosted a Health Equity Summit. The event brings together healthcare professionals, community leaders, researchers, educators, advocates, and patients, and highlights opportunities to advance equity in healthcare and share transformative ideas and ongoing work. But what exactly is health equity, and how does it impact you, me, and everyone around us? Today on Living Healthy Together, we'll sit down with some of the people involved in last year's Health Equity Summit, learn about the experiences and ideas that drove them to join the conversation, and get a glimpse of how health equity works in practice. With us right now are two organizers of the summit, Hajar Anvar, who is the Manager of Integration, Inclusion, and Experience at Continuing Care Services, and Taylor Small, the Director of Health Equity at University of Vermont Medical Center. Taylor and Hajar, thanks so much for joining us. Let's start off with the very basic. What is health equity, and why does it matter to everyone?
Health equity, as we understand it, is really thinking about everyone's potential in achieving their highest level of health and what that means for them. So what that looks like from an institutional level is not defining what those health metrics are, but really following a patient-centered approach as to what healthy and being healthy means for that person. When we're looking at the global scale, it's making sure that our services and practices are available to as much of our community as possible, that folks don't have barriers to access what they need in order to maintain their health.
How does health equity interact with social determinants of health? Are these things inextricably linked? Are they two sides of the same coin? I feel like I might get them mixed up from time to time.
When we're thinking about social determinants of health or health-related social needs, those play into how we achieve health equity. So when we're thinking about how we remove barriers to avoidable or unfair disparities, social determinants of health are one of those metrics that help us gauge where folks are getting access to the care and services they need and where they are not. So when we're looking at food insecurity, when we're looking at economic instability or stability, housing status, transportation, all of those pieces influence whether or not someone is able to attain their highest potential for health.
Hajar, you and Taylor are both involved in the Health Equity Summit, but your work lives are in two very different places. How does health equity work in the continuing care world? Is it different in that space versus an academic medical center? Or is this all the same thing? It works the same no matter where you are.
In continuing care services, we provide care where people call home. So that home can be their actual residence that they're living with their families. It can be a skilled nursing facility, or it can be in a clear mail or respite house where we provide end-of-life care for people away from their home. Health equity in those settings require a high level of cultural humility to enter a private space, really understand how life goes in, and introduce a level of care that's integrated in the way that life goes in those spaces. So from an equity standpoint, it will require also to really listen in and observe what the goals that a person is envisioning for themselves or for their family members would look like for them. How can it be delivered in that specific setting? Is it a safe place for the level of care they require? Do they have all the means in their place to be able to reach those goals? When we get close to the discharge, for example, what happens after we end our connection and care delivery with this person? Are they going to sustain the level of health that they have achieved so far, or there needs to be other plans in place? So we are pretty much tailoring care to every home we enter. And that's a completely different way of approaching these services.
Let's talk for a second about how you both got involved in this work. How did you get interested in pursuing it?
I started my tenure as the co-chair just last year alongside Hajar. And Prior to that, I was not a part of UVM Medical Center, but was an attendee of the Health Equity Summit because of my role in the community. I knew that this was the convening for our community partners, for healthcare leaders, for academic leaders, to be able to come together and have the important conversations as to how we achieve health equity together. Recognizing that there are often these silos created between what's happening in a hospital setting or a community-based setting, what's happening in our academic centers, and then what's happening in the nonprofit realm or from our community leaders. But what we truly recognize is that to be able to get to the solutions that are going to work for everyone, for our employees, and for our patients, it means that we have to bring all of those perspectives to the table to understand the various intersectional approaches to achieving such a hefty goal of health equity.
I was fortunate to be in this work from the beginning, 2022, when it was first imagined. And my first participation in the planning committee was as a representative from Home Health and Hospice. And through that year of partnership, I learned about the vision that was set by Dr. Marissa Coleman, who is the VP of Culture, Experience, and Community Health at UVM Medical Center. The years that came after that, I've learned enough to be able to engage and participate more. And from last year that Taylor and I joined as co-chairs, I found an opportunity to reimagine Health Equity Summit together with Taylor. So that our main intention from last year has been to move this summit beyond the boundaries of healthcare and really focus on the drivers and contributors to health equity at large, where we see a big participation of people beyond healthcare professionals since last year.
That's one of the things that really impressed me looking at last year's program. There are so many folks from such disparate walks of life and disciplines. How did you manage to get them all together for this effort?
We recognize for the two-day summit that we cannot do it on our own. And so we are really grateful for our partnership with UVM, the College of Nursing and Health Sciences, as well as the Lerner College of Medicine, and really expanding that as we go into this next year as to who additional partners are and engaged in this work. So thinking of our Vermont Department of Health and our local Burlington District Office, or other academic centers such as our Community College of Vermont, as well as some likely players who haven't been involved in the past, such as the YMCA of Greater Burlington Area. It really has been a convening of our community who are deeply engaged in this work. And so it doesn't feel as much like work putting the summit together. I don't want to underscore what Hajar and I are doing in the background by any means. But when it truly is just full of joy and love and passion for this work, it brings together folks. This is our time to have the conversations necessary in order to move this effort forward.
What are some of the things in 2025 that were new and kind of growth and development that you were super excited to see take place?
I see the work that we do at Health Equity Summit as just holding a mirror to what is already happening and allowing it to show in that forum. So part of the way that Taylor and I are reimagining this summit is to empower and enable voices to be heard and works to be seen and experiences to be expressed. And in order for that to happen, we need to bring equity to the way that we do the work so that together we can hold a container that is inclusive of all the people who want to be there, either as attendees or as participants or as presenters. Last year, one of the best experiences that we had, I would name two. One was engagement of medical students to organize the poster session for us. We received a high level of engagement, creative ideas, and because of the participation, that session that was joined also by culinary medicine presentation, it was a big success. Not only it was a big event in person, but we also extended that presentation online and gave all the poster presenters an opportunity to have their posters and the ideas be shared in a virtual platform. The other group that really helped us elevate the experience were patient advisors who joined us in abstract review process. For the first time, we had people reviewing the abstracts who are part of the community, who can help us put together submissions that have certain characteristics that they know resonates with people.
Did that surprise you, how receptive people in the community are to this work?
I wouldn't describe it as surprised, because there was a lot of intention behind it for us to get there. But I was impressed. I was impressed to see like all the effort that was put into bringing all those folks in had that outcome. And I got the impression that we must be doing something right. So let's continue this path.
Talk a little bit about where you're at in the development of this year's summit. And if people do want to get involved and they have work or ideas that they want to share, how can they do that?
So it's time to mark your calendars now for our Health Equity Summit happening at the UVM Davis Center and hybrid online on Thursday, September 24th and Friday, September 25th. And right now we are in the call for proposal stage, meaning anyone can submit their proposals of what they might like to present at the Health Equity Summit this year. The call for proposals are open until April 10th, and you can access that portal by going to our website on the uvmhealth.org page and searching for the 2026 Health Equity Summit. And I really do not want folks to feel limited by or this idea of I need letters next to my name or I need a certain level of education or even preparation and being able to present to be able to submit your proposals. We really are open to the diverse perspectives of our community and what you are seeing as equitable actions that we can take to improve the health of our community. I'm excited by the submissions that we have already received and looking forward to expanding what that might look like in the new year.
And if you're listening to this as a podcast, we'll link the Health Equity Summit portal in the description of the episode. So check that out to get involved and for more information on the event later this year. Right now, it's time for a quick break, but when we come back on Living Healthy Together, we'll sit down with a storyteller and performer whose work has touched thousands of students, artists, and residents across Vermont and nationwide, and learn how art can impact health equity. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Living Healthy Together, where we're diving into the annual Health Equity Summit at University of Vermont Health. We're joined now by Fareen Paris, a Burlington-based storyteller and artist and founder of All Heart Inspirations, and also the closing speaker at the 2025 Health Equity Summit. Fareen, thanks so much for joining us and for sharing insight and your experience as an artist. Talk a little bit about All Heart Inspirations and your journey as a storyteller and an artist. How did you come to found All Heart?
All Heart Inspirations was birthed out of a need that the community was desperately missing. It was in the midst of COVID. It was 2020. The world was shutting down. And so many of us were asking, what is my gift? What can I do? What does the city need? What does my community need? And I was on a mission already prior to the pandemic starting to resign from my previous role, which was at the University of Vermont. I came from a background in higher education for 15 plus years. And I used to incorporate a lot of storytelling narrative with the work that I did with New Student Transition. How do we create a place of sense and belonging? So I just believe in the deep power of our personal narratives that we each individually have to be the author of our story. And All Heart Inspirations was birth to create as many vulnerable, heart-centered, people-centered, let's slow us down, let's be in the moment, let's remind ourselves that we are the authors of our story. We own it, we've lived it, and we are deserving of spaces to uplift it. That is the mission. And it's been one of the most beautiful journeys that I've had in my lifetime. It is just a joy creating spaces for people to come together. The stage is what continues to transform. I've story told on the sailboats on Lake Champlain. I've story told in the City Hall Park, the Flynn main stage, so many different schools as an artist in residence, even just on the streets with activism. And why are we here today? The vibe is always storytelling, but the people, the topic, the environment, that is what we continue to remix to create the moments.
You're an accomplished storyteller. You've worked in a wide variety of places and spaces. Was the Health Equity Summit last year your first foray into a healthcare space? What was that like?
I've been very blessed since All Heart Inspirations started in 2020. I've done a variety of collaborations with the UVM Medical Center. My first collaboration had to do with centering our new American youth and what are their stories that could inform health practitioners to hold them in a more holistic way. And so myself as a storyteller and a photographer, we worked with students from AALV and we invited them to tell their narrative through photography, and then they would orally present it. And we had practitioners come and different community members. You know, it's like you're hearing a story about someone who once loved soccer and now they're no longer doing it. But then you put that lens of, so how does this relate back to health inequity? Well, what I heard was that this Black woman, femme student really enjoyed soccer. It was something that was a part of her identity. But as she was moving through her Winooski High School, what she could not handle anymore was some of the racial slurs and other incidences that were happening at the game. And sometimes this student felt that it was on her to fix the problem. And she was asking, where is my coach? And so for her, she had to let go of the sport. She didn't want to, but she just didn't want to hold both, like playing the sport and needing to hold spaciousness for racism and microaggressions. That, for me, from a health equity mindset, that is a gap, because we're having now students lose access to something that gave them movement, that gave them a circle, that gave them mentorship. You know, we don't want our students of color phasing out of sports here in Vermont. Like, what is going on? And I did notice that particularly girls of color is what I tend to see kind of phase out. Both my daughters do sports. And so it was really beautiful to have a student just tell the story. And then I came in to be like, so this is what you're going to pull from it. If you were their doctor, I've come to participate on panels where I've been able to just kind of share my lens. There was one month where I was invited to talk about my Haitian culture and the role that plays. And I've also been involved in some assessment things. For example, the hospital wanted to be better about finding products for brown and Black people to get cared for their hair. And so being asked to try products and express what they felt like, and it is so important for people to have what they need to take care of their crowns that are on their heads. And hearing a narrative that you had medical people like taking olive oil from the cafeteria because there was nothing on the floor that was adequate to tend to the beautiful hair that is, for me, these coils, you know, the Afro diaspora hair, right? And so let's get actual products in so that we don't have to take the olive oil. That's this. It's like going deeper, because there's so much more if we're willing to lean in and be honest about what is it that we're trying to unpack and uplift.
As a storyteller that's very familiar with healthcare and the lived experience of health inequity, what's your message to medical professionals and the general public? What are some of the things that make the greatest impact for you?
For me, my closing keynote that I did for the Health Equity Summit, the stories that I centered and shared were various examples of what health equity can look like, because it's not just simply getting someone into the doctor's office. And for me, when I had the opportunity to reflect on what it looks like for my collective health in Vermont, are there gaps? Absolutely, especially as a Black woman. There are a lot of gaps. 80% of Black women experience fibroids by the time they're 50. And nobody in my lifetime, no doctor had ever told me that. It was a group of Black women watching football with me that helped me diagnose that what the pain that I had been feeling for over a year was fibros. And I ended up having a hysterectomy. And so I was trying to remind folks, what does health equity look like? It does look like a group of friends, even though you're doing something like social and fun, to take a moment and share lived experiences, because that is what empowered me to even know that I needed a hysterectomy. That care looks like when my car, unfortunately, years ago, somebody wrote the N-word on my car. And that guts me. That guts me like somebody breaking their ankle, like for real. And what did health equity look like? That was a neighbor in the community rallying a bunch of people to come chalk our family's driveway from top to bottom, reminding us that you are loved. Because, you know, therapy had already happened that week. I want to believe that we can head into the direction of what is health equity if we can dismantle who are the, like, experts of our health. Because not everybody has access to go to the doctors. Not everybody has access for insurance. Not everybody has access to even feel comfortable to step out of their neighborhood right now. So we need to educate our community about the roles that we all play. I would love to see more spaces that can empower the everyday person to understand we have such a deep responsibility to each other right now. And I want folks to understand. That's why I center love in a lot of what I do. That word has been unfortunately centered around romance, but that feeling, love is an action, not just a feeling. And when I think of equity, I just kept inviting people, what does it look like to love your patient? What does it look like to love your client? That word, let's get comfortable, because all it simply means is that I am committing to taking an action in order to let you know that you are seen, witnessed, loved, held, whatever it may be. And I hope health equity can allow folks to bring that four-letter word into the spaces, because for me, it's transformed the way that I work with my primary care doctor, Dr. Culkins. I love that woman. She is such a vibe. But it works because we actually do center love. I do feel that she loves me in a way that a doctor is looking out for their patient and hoping that when they leave your office, that they thrive until you see them again. So that's my little secret mission too. I say I carry love like contraband in my chest, and I just sneak it into anywhere. And that's what the health equity was. And I think it was beautiful that they allowed me to hold that space the way that I wanted to hold it. And I was really grateful for that.
It's time for a break here on Living Healthy Together. When we come back, we'll sit down with an artist and executive assistant at UVM Medical Center who channeled her own lived experience with intimate partner violence into action by sharing creative strategies that can help survivors process trauma. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Living Healthy Together, where we're asking the question, what does health equity in practice look like? We're joined now by Elle Semsi, an executive assistant at UVM Medical Center's Departments of Culture, Experience, and Community Health and Hospital Services. Elle, thanks for joining us today. Last year, you got involved in the Health Equity Summit with a presentation focused on painting through PTSD and healing from intimate partner violence. Was this your first foray into this kind of work? How did you get involved?
I've actually changed the name a couple times. I think I kind of landed on healing from intimate partner violence through art. It was my first time being a presenter. I have been involved in the Health Equity Summit for around 4 years, so all except the very first one. But this was my first time presenting and even doing a project like this, where I've taken my lived experience and looked at it through a lens of research and tried to share that to the world.
You went right to a 10. This is a doozy of an experience for anyone to share. Do you want to talk about what led you to become interested in this work?
Yeah, I went all out for my first time bringing lived experience to this. So I've experienced different kinds of trauma throughout my life. And as I've been working in the department I'm working at now, I've gained a lot of confidence to take that lived experience and use it to help shape and change impacts for other folks that may be experiencing similar things. And so I've gained this confidence and level of comfortability to be like, okay, you know what? I'm going to go all out. I am going to bring this to folks and just see if this makes a difference. So growing up, my first relationship was a domestic abuse relationship, and I was in that for many, many years. And something that helped me through that was drawing, painting, because it's hard sometimes. The brain kind of disconnects and doesn't know how to use words, and the creative process really helped me. So looking back on that experience, I'm finally far enough away from it so I can look at it in a different perspective and kind of see the full picture and feel comfortable enough kind of going back into that and using it to help others. So taking that experience and really thinking about it again and saying, okay, I can talk about this art and how it's helped me now that that's many years behind me.
What was it like flipping the script and going from someone who experienced something to now you're taking action, you are leading work and communicating resources to other folks? What's that like?
It wasn't something that I ever expected that I would be. Never expected that I would be in a place that I'm in now to be able to look back and be like, look at how far I've come. And at that point, I would say when I was in it, and I was in kind of like this survivor mode, I never thought I would be on the other side of it, let alone being able to really look at it and research and use this to help others. So it is so powerful. And it still like surprises me every day that I have this capability to not only be outside of that traumatic situation, but just the fact that I'm able to have the strength to look back at what I went through and use that to help others. So it surprises me every day because, I mean, even 5 years ago, I would have never thought that this is something I could do.
One of the reasons I was so happy that you were able to come on and talk today is that this is an expression of health equity in action. It's not just, oh, let's talk about it. Oh, let's have a lecture. Let's think about it. These are things that work and that people can do. I can sit here and read, trauma often affects the part of the brain responsible for language and speech. And so that means survivors might struggle to verbalize their experiences. It's very easy to say those two sentences, but can you explain what that means? What do survivors often go through and how can art enhance that?
Kind of going back to why I chose this modality, and part of my presentation as well included a canvas that I put out that I did the Health Equity Summit logo, and I had folks as they were walking by color into it so they could kind of read the poster session I created. It's pretty heavy. It's heavy stuff. So they can also experience what it's like to go through something a little heavier, to be in a stressful situation, and also be able to have a creative outlet at the same time. And so what I felt when I was going through my experience was it kind of took me out of my world a little bit, and it allowed me to process things in ways that I couldn't. I could paint scenes that made me feel better, and I couldn't comprehend why that felt good. And I was like, I wonder if this is a thing, right? So when I was doing research on it, what I found is just how art therapy can reduce PTSD symptoms for everyone, and it can regulate the nervous system, and that this is a real thing that folks are using in schools, shelters, clinics, community centers. And I didn't know that. And so I wanted to kind of take a moment to be like, this is a thing that is accessible, that we can all do. Even if you just take like a box of crayons and a piece of paper, it makes a huge difference.
Did that growth in understanding and reflection change your relationship to your art?
Oh, that is such a good question, because that was actually a really big takeaway that I had, even just doing this work and doing this research. And then I went back and started painting again. And the difference that I felt was, I'm a bit of a perfectionist, and I push that out as much as I could. Like, I can start something that I don't like, and I can just paint on top of it. And if it comes out terrible, I just call it abstract, and it doesn't have to be perfect. And it's really how I'm feeling while I'm doing it. I don't have to end the day with this beautiful, aesthetically pleasing painting or drawing. It's really the process that is a benefit. And if it comes out looking like something that I want to put on my wall, awesome. But it's really the process of doing it. And it was just really healing, kind of dropping that perfectionism, at least in that aspect of my life.
What was it like becoming a health researcher? How did that experience go? Were you surprised by anything, whether it's what you found out or how you actually lived that process?
For folks that know me, I love data. I love spreadsheets. I love graphs. It's my jam. So being able to take something like my lived experience and being able to meld that into something that brings me so much joy was incredible. And I was like, well, maybe I can do this. I don't know if there's going to be enough data on this because I really want the numbers. And it was all there. And it felt incredible. Like, I'm the kid, I'm going to college right now, but I'm the one who's like, oh, I love homework. Let's do the thing. So it was really satisfying for me to be able to have both aspects in this work. And going through the process was like, oh, I want to do more of this. It's really good. And going through and finding the data that I found was incredibly validating. It was a really great self-growing journey for me to go through and get that validation in a way that I haven't before.
What was your favorite part about being involved in last year's Health Equity Summit, whether it be the reception or something you heard from folks during the summit itself?
It was so scary for me to stop being the person behind the curtain, which I am in a lot of aspects, as that's usually my role. It was really scary until everyone started coming in. I got there early. I put up my poster. I was like, oh my gosh, am I going to like pass out? I was so nervous. And then people started coming in and having conversations with me. And I'm an extremely introverted person. And I was like, I don't know if I'm going to be able to handle it. And there was just this feeling of community and comfort. And also I found the strength in myself to be like, I'm a survivor and I have a voice, and just the privilege that I have to be able to have this conversation is beautiful. So it went from fear to being like, oh my gosh, this is amazing. How lucky am I? Going from getting out of high school, becoming a hairdresser, then jumping into healthcare and now doing this. It was a huge moment. I will say, after doing the poster presentation, I must have slept for like 13 hours. It was amazing, but I was like, okay, recharge moment.
For all the folks out there, right, who hear introvert and think, oh, this is someone who can't be in the same room with people. That's not the way introversion works, right? I'm an introvert too. We're just like you. It's just that we don't fill our bucket by interacting with people. That takes out of our bucket. So when Elle is talking about recharging, that's what being an introvert means.
Yeah. So anyone who's listening to this and saying, oh, I can't do it, I'm super introverted, and all the people, you can do it. Yeah, you may have to sleep for a little bit after. Everyone processes and heals in their own way.
How did you get into art? Has this always been a part of who you are? Or did you come to it later in life?
I definitely was not a super artsy person. I would make comics when I was little. I made a cartoon character called Super Dog that my mom was like, this is the best thing that's ever happened. But that was about the extent of my artistic abilities. But my cousin has an art business and she does it full time. And we do some painting together and got me really confident in the work. And when I was 18 and I started kind of getting in that domestic abuse situation and going through trauma, I would just scribble. I would make little symbols, I would do little spirals, and I would just do it really small and just take up an entire page eventually. So it wasn't any sort of artistic, beautiful landscape that I was doing, but just like little scribbles that would just help my mind kind of take a break. But as I've gotten more confident, I'm like doing like legit painting. I'm like painting birds and landscapes and all these different art mediums that I never thought I would. It definitely did not come from an artist background for sure.
It's a journey of personal discovery and artistic growth, and you've managed to take this stop along the way and help other people grow and develop through their own trauma. That's incredible. What do you see as an investment that needs to be made in this space? Are there one or two investments at the community level to help folks who are going through these situations that should be made?
If there was a place like dedicated areas with crafts and scrapbooking and painting, art supplies are really expensive. And I feel like the arts, that's the first thing that funds are taken away from. And even gardening, any sort of creative practice, a place where folks can just kind of go in and paint and draw and be in community with folks, with supplies that they can use and that they can take home and that they can share with loved ones, I think would be huge. We all have stuff that we're going through. We've all experienced trauma. And I would encourage everyone to, whatever it looks like, whether it be doing a puzzle or gardening and painting, drawing, just take a second, even if it's just 10 minutes in your day, put everything else aside and just have that moment of creative expression. And it doesn't have to be perfect. It doesn't. Just take that moment for yourself and whatever that looks like, because it can be impactful.
What about the Health Equity Summit and health equity as a topic? You've been involved with this from almost the very beginning. You've seen it grow. You've seen it develop. Where should it go next? Where is it going to go next?
It has grown so much just in our community. We're expanding. We're getting proposals from across the U.S. It's beautiful. And especially right now, we need to continue expanding. And I think that looks like including more voices of folks with lived experience. And I do see that as being the direction that we are headed. It's providers, it's clinicians, it's folks speaking to research and things that are tried and true, you know, but there is something so different about hearing it straight from the people that went through the experience. And I think that's something that the summit is really good at. There are patients who speak and folks like myself who have experience things that can go like, hey, this is how it impacted me personally. And I think that's what's really needed. And it needs to be survivor-centered and also trauma-informed, because we all experience trauma. And as a community, there has been plenty of traumatic events like COVID and things that we have all experienced. And I really see us going down that path.
We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, you'll hear from a pediatrician and clinical educator whose passion for caring for patients with intellectual disabilities traces back to her own experience as a big sister. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Living Healthy Together. We're talking about health equity and the annual Health Equity Summit today. Joining us now is Dr. Jill Reinhart, a primary care pediatrician, the director of the pediatric residency program at University of Vermont Medical Center, and the Vice Chair of Inclusivity and Belonging for Pediatrics at Golisano Children's Hospital. Dr. Reinhart, thanks so much for joining us. Talk about your role in last year's Health Equity Summit. You led a workshop there focused on addressing health disparities for folks with intellectual and developmental disabilities. Talk a little bit about what this body of work is and how you became interested in it.
Yeah, I had the privilege of working with Special Olympics over many, many years. I also grew up as an older sibling of two kids with intellectual disability. So this subject is really close to me. In my primary care practice, I was outside of the network for about 20 years and sort of grew a practice primarily of kids with either medical issues or intellectual disabilities. And so just as a passion within pediatrics, this topic has become really important to me. As part of the Health Equity Summit, we recognize and some personal experiences with my own patients within our system too, of providers and staff who just aren't familiar with best practice for caring for people with intellectual disabilities. I think because of that developmental component to working with people with intellectual disabilities, pediatrics seems a little bit more prepared for that within training. You know, we know to negotiate with a seven-year-old to, like, do you want to bring your teddy bear or your stethoscope to the doctor's office today instead of saying, do you want to go to the doctor? Because they're probably going to say no. And those types of negotiations are necessary for working with people with intellectual disabilities. And I just don't think we're necessarily trained to do that. So during our summit, I had the privilege of working with two athlete ambassadors from Special Olympics who could talk to their lived experience and provide some guidance to an audience of mostly clinicians. Along with that, a colleague of mine, Tom Griffin from University of Vermont, who's also interested in research in this space, and one of the vice presidents of programming, Rachel Ham Vaughn. And so together, really, it was an opportunity for people in the audience to hear from patients themselves about their experiences and what works best for them, and then to hear a little bit about the true disparities and the real need for improving the care for this population from a health perspective.
How receptive are folks to this information? I saw some scholarship from a long time ago now, 2014, saying a ton has happened and many advances have been made, but there's still so much more to do. That was more than 10 years ago now. Where are we at? And has progress been made in terms of the receptiveness of people to these concerns?
I think clinicians are really open to anything that's going to help them feel better about the medicine that they practice. And a lot of the things that we're talking about, some of it's knowledge that this is the population that's at much higher risk for missing health screenings, just like pap smears and mammograms and prostate exams. Those things don't happen as easily in this population, especially as they age into adulthood. And so my experience with our community is that anything that's going to give us some information to get an edge to help patients more from an individual level is, I think, welcome.
You've had almost a year now to reflect on what happened in 2025 at the summit. Was there anything that surprised you or anything that was a keynote moment for you?
Because I'm so engrossed in this area and immersed in it all the time, I forget that even the simple things can make a big difference. One of the things that we talk about is it's so important to our young people with intellectual disabilities is talking to them, talking directly to them in the patient space. And to me, that just seems like, oh, that's so easy. This is silly to be talking about. But it really hit home for many of the people in the audience that talking directly to the patient, not just to the person who may be helping them interpret the medical literacy levels in the room. There may be a parent or a guardian or a person that is their staff from where they live. But still to highlight that individual is there to care for themselves. So talking directly to people. And then using what we call plain language, but it's really breaking it down into like one idea per sentence, not using jargon. And this is beneficial, I think, to all patients, really just to take a pause and use real words. And I was struck by how many people afterwards who came up to me reflected on this may seem really simple, but those two things really hit home for me.
What was it like to work with those ambassadors from the Special Olympics? That must have been really cool to see them in action and to hear their stories.
It is amazing. I tend to overprepare in being sort of the conduit between the Health Equity Summit and a community organization. I was sort of prepared to just jump in and do it. I think I talked about maybe two or three slides during the whole thing. I had one little medical piece and they just ran the show. And I think that's another piece of this is to assume confidence wherever you can and not to make judgment. This is something that is incredibly important to those ambassadors and they live it every day. And so, of course, they're experts, regardless of what their diagnoses may be. It was a real hoot, actually. We broke into small groups, and so each athlete had a smaller group. And that was also reflected by the small group leaders, how competent and passionate and what actual great teachers the athlete ambassadors were.
The other thing that struck me was both the scope and the severity of the health impacts that folks with developmental and intellectual disabilities experience. Individuals with Down syndrome may die up to 20 years earlier than the general population. And that's not because of any medical issue related directly to Down syndrome. And there's more there. There's cardiovascular disease, there's obesity, there's diabetes, epilepsy, thyroid disorders, all of this stuff. It's shocking how big a health impact these folks have.
Yeah, and that's what my piece of the workshop was about, to give the data around these health inequities. They are less likely to be screened for things like cervical cancer, breast cancer. They are more at risk for social isolation and have fewer social and emotional supports. And their experience of a suicide risk is literally 3 times higher than the general population. And it's 6 times higher in autistic individuals. And to your comment about those with Down syndrome, that is irrespective of whether they've had congenital heart disease as part of their diagnoses or not. Generally, people with intellectual disabilities are twice as more likely to die before age 50 than adults without intellectual disabilities. And we have to think that's more related to the comorbidities of things like heart disease, obesity complications, and social isolation.
What role do events like the Health Equity Summit play in addressing these health-related impacts? What's your insight as someone who not only understands, but then takes action? How do we take action?
As someone who lives in this world, I was actually shocked at the numbers of adults with intellectual disability that have comorbidities that could be prevented. And so I think when we, as physicians in medical homes for adults or children, think about this population, we really have to recognize that we need to put into place screening. And it's a different experience for a 35-year-old with intellectual disability than it is for a neurotypical person. And so how can we support those screening activities in the community? And instead of just saying, oh, it's too hard to do that. And so we have things like the comfort zone that is working to desensitize people who've had traumatic experiences with the medical system as one way of helping to desensitize folks to this. But also just being able to practice, like, this is what a mammogram is going to be like. It's going to pinch. It's not going to be comfortable, but you'll get through it. It'll be fine. And that just takes a little more proactive care. But ultimately, that helps equalize the playing field for these individuals.
That's all the time we have today on Living Healthy Together. Thanks to all our guests for being with us and sharing their stories and insights. If you're out there listening and have a question, comment, or idea for a future episode, email us at healthtalk@uvmhealth.org. Living Healthy Together is also available as a podcast. If you're interested in checking out some of our past episodes, look us up wherever you listen to podcasts. Be sure to follow, subscribe, and consider giving us that 5-star rating, which really helps a lot. I'm your host, Philip Rao. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.